Okay. So, welcome back to our third Lunch Learn here. So, we wanted to discuss the topic of Pinchas and Eliyahu. And by that, what I mean is that I'm sure many of us have heard the idea. Maybe if we haven't heard it, you'll hear it now for the first time. And that is that Pinchas, at the end of his life, whatever that means, he became Eliyahu, Hanavi, right? Eliyahu the prophet, Elijah the prophet. And that they are essentially one and the same. So there's a famous idea. It's based off a Medrash. We'll see a few sources that discuss it in particular as well. But let's just start off with that idea as a general rule, that we know that Eliyahu and Pinchas are the same person, and the question really will become, why are they considered to be the same person, and do we actually really believe they were the same person, or were they just compared to one another but not actually one and the same? Before we even get to that point, and if you aren't familiar with those midrashim, it's okay, we'll see some of them inside. Let's just open up with a question by asking, what was Pinchas famous for, right? The part of this week is Pinchas. What is he famous for?
He's the grandson of Aaron.
And okay.
He put the spear between, right. You know, it was an illicit relationship.
Yeah.
Right. And also the Jewish person, right?
Right.
Zimri and Cosby were having these illicit relations in front of everyone, and he came out and he decided to stab them because it was such a terrible thing.
Right.
Was it because if they would have been more private about it, would he have done that? Was
he
it
would not have seen.
He wouldn't have seen. True.
What was he doing in the street? I mean, you know, but, like that he could see them.
Right. So they clearly were in the wrong, right?
Right.
The question is, was Pinchas in the right? How do we feel about his actions?
I mean, I know that he's considered righteous for doing it, but it seems like very violent.
Right. It's very hard to understand.
Yeah.
But if you're behaving inappropriately and he just sort of was in, listen, I wouldn't kill anybody, but I see an inappropriate behavior that makes me I'm ashamed.
Right.
And it's a big gay parade in Tel Aviv, I was ashamed.
Right. So we're not going to discuss the acts of Pinchas, the passion that Pinchas has, we for sure can admire. No matter what our actual beliefs are, at the end of the day, God and His laws and His teachings, that was something that was very, very beautiful.
Right.
Now, so we're not going to discuss the actual actions that he took, but rather we're going to discuss the reward that he had and how that led to everything that we know about him. So let's take a look at source number one to really just break in. So it's Gemara and Bava Metzia. And the reason why we're bringing this source is that we'll see in a moment that from this Gemara we can imply that everyone seemed to believe that Pinchas and Eliyahu were the same person. And we'll try to develop this a little bit more and see why that is the case. So take a look at source number one. Rabbi Bar Abuha found Eliyahu standing in a graveyard of Gentiles. Those of us who may not be familiar with Eliyahu in the Gemara, Eliyahu always comes up throughout all of our Shas, throughout all of the Gemaras, and he just pops in every now and again. He is sort of this guy bringing interesting tidings, or he may have a message for someone, or he might just be there just to give something over. But he really pops up a lot, and it's sort of hard to understand theologically what does that mean, that Eliyahu is always popping up. Why is he always around? A little unclear. But that is what he does. So Eliyahu was standing in this cemetery, and it was a cemetery of non-Jews. And so Rabbi Bar Abuha asked him, is not the master a priest? Right? So Rabbi Bar Abuha wanted to know, Eliyahu, aren't you a Kohen? Why would he think that he's a Kohen?
Because then he would be Pinchas.
Okay, good. We'll get there. What is the reason that the master is standing in a cemetery? Eliyahu said to him, has the master not studied the Mishnaic order of Taharot? As it is taught in a Braisa, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says that the graves of Gentiles do not render one impure, as it says, and you, my sheep, the sheep of my pasture, are man, which teaches that you, the Jewish people, are considered man for the, that you can't become impure by them, but Gentiles are not called man when it comes to purity and impurity for being that a corpse can give over. Since the Torah states with regard to ritual impurity imparted in a tent, the man dies in a tent, evidently impurity imparted by a tent does not apply to Gentiles. So therefore Eliyahu HaNavi says, even though I am a Kohen, he agrees he is a Kohen, nonetheless he's allowed to be in the cemetery for non-Jews because non-Jews do not give over impurity in the same way that a dead Jewish body would give over impurity. Good? Rashi then takes this source and he says, I only have the Hebrew, but I will translate in source number two. So, de'ika leman de'amar, right? Because there is one opinion, says Rashi, de'Eliyahu hu Pinchas. Eliyahu is Pinchas, Dechtiv Be Kana Kanasi, that when it comes to Eliyahu, it says that he was a very zealous person. V'chim bePinchas beKanu es Kanasi, that Pinchas was also a very zealous person. So what is Rashi saying over here? He's saying that there is an idea that Pinchas is considered like Eliyahu, and the reason why we know that he is Eliyahu is why? Because both of them were zealous people. What do we think about that? In other words, he's basically saying that the reason why we know they're the same person is because they had a similar attribute. Do we buy into that? Do we not buy into that?
Well, you could buy into it. I mean, they could have said, but that doesn't mean they're the same people. Right. We could be the same person, but we're not. Yeah, I'm not you, you're not me.
Right. In other words, we could have similar traits. We can both be passionate people, but that doesn't mean we're the same person. So why would Rashi be drawn to say that they are the same person?
Just like you can say Rishava.
What do you mean?
Same words in different places.
Okay, so what Mark is bringing up is there's an idea that we have throughout Shas is that sometimes when we have words in one place and words in another place, we'll compare the two of them and we'll say that they're talking about the same thing. Right? We have that many times throughout Shas. So maybe over here are the same. So just like we have the same exact words with Pinchas and the same exact words with Eliyahu, maybe that means that text is trying to teach us a wink-wink secret that they really are the same person. Okay, I don't know if we actually need to use that exact mechanism, but it's an interesting point.
And my other question is, can you have that with Torah and Navi? Or...
In theory, yes. The reason why we don't is because the Gzeir Shav is usually only used to learn out halachos. All right. When it comes to an interesting idea like this, you can make the point, but you wouldn't actually care to use that mechanism. And since all the laws, for the most part, we learn out of the Torah, not the rest of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, so you might not do that. Yeah,
so is Rashi referring all to the physical attributes?
What do you mean? In other words, did they look the same?
Right. In other words, is when he said they had similar attributes, he didn't say they have similar qualities or they do similar chesed. That he said they have similar attributes. So
okay.
Did he use that term to also refer to physical attributes?
So what we're not going to discuss, which is a fascinating conversation in its own right, but I'll save it for the Kabbalists, was Pinchas... If you assume that Pinchas is Eliyahu, was Pinchas reincarnated to become Eliyahu, or did Pinchas just never die and then he magically transformed into this Eliyahu character and he just started going by a different name at some point in his life? So if you assume that he was reincarnated, then he doesn't have to have the same physical attributes. If you assume that he just became Eliyahu at some point, then he just changed his name, then seemingly the physical attributes were the same, right? Because it's literally the same person, just with a new name.
Right.
Carol, did you?
Yeah, I was thinking that's probably the second thing. I don't think he was reincarnated.
You think that he
he
means
he,
for real?
As he grew up, as he got older, he became more like Eliyahu.
Yeah.
He took on the attribute.
This new persona, Eliyahu. He had an identity.
He
changed his identity.
Yeah,
okay.
Nice.
Okay. So... Let's take a look at source number three. So source number three is the specific passage in which Rashi is referring to, showing how Eliyahu is someone who was kana kanasi, that he was a zealous person. Take a look inside. Source number three. After a while, the son of the mistress of the house fell sick. Hold up on what I just said for a moment. Source number three, what it does is that it introduces another question, right? What might, from what we know about Eliyahu, and maybe we don't know that much, and then we'll have to see source number three, but before we get there, does anyone know any interesting things about Eliyahu that would compromise the fact that he was a Kohen? What do we know about Kohanim? What can they not do?
Well, they can't go to the cemetery.
Can't go to a cemetery. Why not? Because they can't come in touch with
a dead
person. Okay. Do we know any stories about the life of Eliyahu that would compromise that fact if we assume that he is Pinchas and therefore is a Kohen?
Didn't he revive someone?
Okay, good. Now we take a look at source number three. Source number three is the story about Eliyahu reviving someone. After a while, the son of the mistress of the house fell sick, and his illness grew worse until he had no breath left in him. She said to Eliyahu, "What harm have I done you, O man of God, that you should come here to recall my sin and cause the death of my son? Give me the boy," he said to her, and taking him from her arms, he carried him to the upper chamber where he was staying and laid him down on his own bed. He cried out to the Lord and said, "O Lord, my God, will you bring calamity upon this widow whose guest I am? And let her son die." Then he stretched out over the child three times and cried out to the Lord, saying, "O Lord, my God, let this child's life return to his body." The Lord heard Eliyahu's plea. The child's life returned to his body and he revived. So what's problematic with this passage if we assume Eliyahu was a Kohen?
He was around a dead person.
How do you know the boy was dead?
Well, because it says that he returned life to his body. Yeah. So maybe he just fainted.
So
that's true.
Okay. Right. So there are a few points that you need to get across to assume that this passage might be a problem for Eliyahu, right? One is to assume that this person was dead in the first place. It could be from the passage that you could read it. I'll say it like this. If you assume that Eliyahu brought someone back to life, then you have other major theological questions like, do we actually believe that one individual has the ability to bring someone else back to life if they die? Do we believe in that?
No.
I don't know. Maybe we do.
We could use this today for what's the real definition of death.
Oh,
I mean, he may not. He wasn't brain dead. He stopped breathing, and Eliyahu resuscitated him. So
maybe he had a stenosis that clicked in again afterwards.
Right.
Okay.
I mean,
it's a very complicated passage. Yeah. It's very unclear exactly what was going on over
here. That he was dead.
Right. No, okay. Good.
Or it could have been choking if it said that he had no breath left.
What most Mefarshim seem to understand from this is that in some way, shape, or form, he was dead. And to the point that he was dead, I don't know, but certainly he seems to have been past the point that a Kohen had no business being there. For example, a Kohen should not really be, if there's someone who is about to die, a Kohen probably should not be in that room either because of the chance that he can die, he or she can die very soon.
Yeah, but there are always gray areas. There are Kohanim who are physicians. They had to have gotten through medical school.
That's a very complicated topic. Not for right now, but that's a very complicated question. So over here with Eliyahu, so we do have to overcome this hurdle. If we do assume that this boy was dead in some way, shape, or form, how did he, if assuming he was Pinchas, therefore assuming he was a Kohen, how did he have the ability to touch this dead boy? So what might you answer?
Well, first I would say that I don't think the boy was dead. But
okay,
well,
but let's assume he is dead.
Okay, so how did he have the ability to do this? If he was a Kohen?
Yeah.
Well, here's an interesting thing. Maybe it was at the beginning of his Kohenim. And maybe...
Kahanis.
And maybe he was just a human person seeing somebody was dead and he was crying out to it. But maybe he became more pious, more Navi kind. Later on,
it's an interesting point, but it's hard to believe. Again, if we assume that this is Pinchas, this guy is several hundred years old then, and that means he's been a Kohen for a very long time. So it's hard to believe that he hasn't grown into that part of himself yet.
Maybe he's not, but I don't know.
Right. So one perspective is then to say, you know what? Based on this alone, we know that Pinchas was righteous. We know that Eliyahu was righteous. Right. If Eliyahu was a Kohen, there's no way a righteous Kohen would be involved in something like this. Therefore, what would you say? Maybe it's not actually Pinchas. Eliyahu was some other Joe Schmo, and... Yeah, we have a phone here. Eliyahu was some other Joe Schmo, and... again, not a Joe Schmo, but he wasn't Pinchas, and therefore, we don't have to assume he was a Kohen, therefore there was no issue. Or, take a look at source number 4. Tosfos, on that Gemara, has an answer. He says as follows, again, it's in Hebrew, but we'll translate very carefully. He says, Tema Leri. There is one of the Baal Tosos, one of the individuals who is often quoted in Tosos, named the Ri. He had a big question over here. Heach hichya bina shel ha'almana. How in the world did Eliyahu have the right to resuscitate this dead boy of this widow? Kevan shekohen haya. He was a priest. How did he have the right? So he answers, V'yesh lomar shehaya barur lo. He was sure, Eliyahu was positive, that he would have the ability to resuscitate him. And therefore, since he was positive that he would be able to resuscitate him, it became a question of pikuach nefesh. We know that when it comes to pikuach nefesh, if there's a chance that a person is going to die, we do anything we could do to save him. So even though Eliyahu was a Kohen, indeed, you cannot argue with that, nonetheless, he had every right to save him because he knew that he would for sure be able to save this dead boy. Therefore, it doesn't make a difference. There's no issue that he was a Kohen. That was overridden in this specific case. Good? Like that, Carol doesn't like it so much.
I like that one.
You're thinking about it.
Yeah.
Okay, so going
I
back...
I actually was thinking about it and thought it was a little far-fetched, so I didn't bring it up.
Well, it seems like you and Tosfos are on the same page. Okay, going back to...
We're both a little out there.
Going back to why Pinchas and Eliyahu are considered to be the same people. So take a look at source number 5. Now, source number 5 is the exact passage that Rashi was quoting, saying that Eliyahu was a person who had zeal. So take a look, source number 5. There he went into a cave, and there he spent the night. Then the word of the Lord came to him. He said to him, "Why are you here, Eliyahu?" So in this passage, I did not bring the entire text here, but Eliyahu was essentially running for his life. They were trying to kill him. And so God asks Eliyahu, "Why are you here?" He replied, and take a look at the bolded words, "I am moved by zeal for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to the sword. I alone am left, and they are out to take my life." So over here, Eliyahu identifies as someone who is a very zealous person. And based on that, Rashi says, oh, this must be Pinchas. Why? So take a look at source number 6. These are the psukim from our own Parsha at the very beginning. The Lord said to Moshe, saying, "Pinchas, son of Elazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, has turned back my wrath from the Israelites by displaying among them his zeal for me, so that I did not wipe out the Israelite people in my zeal. Say, therefore, I grant him my pact of friendship. It shall be for him and his descendants after him a pact of priesthood for all time, because he took an action of zeal for his God, thus making an atonement for the Israelites. The name of the Israelite who was killed, the one who was killed with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, son of Salu, chieftain of Shimon, and Shimon's ancestral house." Now, so it's these two passages. These are the only two things that Rashi seems to allude to that say that this is how we know that Pinchas and Eliyahu are the same person. So, do we think that's a strong connection or not?
I have 30 seconds. I don't think it's a strong connection, but I think if you want to make a case for it, you can.
Okay, good. So there are two perspectives with this connection. Either you can say it's a really nice idea, or you can say it's a beginning of a proof, right? So we have a textual connection, and then if you want a further connection, what might you use as a further proof that Eliyahu was indeed Pinchas?
That he was not Pinchas?
No, that he was.
Oh, that he was?
You could use the first Gemara that we had, right? Where Rabba Bar Avuha met Eliyahu, and Eliyahu immediately identified himself as a Kohen. And in that situation, we have to assume that he was talking about the fact that he was Pinchas, and therefore he was a Kohen. So now, in order to really get to the bottom of this, because even though you have this interesting textual allusion, and you have this interesting Agadic Gemara, right? This Gemara that's telling a story that's hard to understand if this is actually true or not, right? In other words, did it actually happen, or was it like a dream that Rabba Bar Avuha had? It's a little unclear. So in order to understand if this is actually real, if Pinchas and Eliyahu are the same person, we need to understand three things. Anyone want to take a shot at what these three things are that we have to understand? Yeah. What do we have to uncover to be able to determine if this is indeed true, that Pinchas and Eliyahu are the same person?
We have to uncover...
See, you know what I like about Carol? Every time I ask a question, Carol feels like it's being personally asked
her. I feel like...
I mean that in a nice way.
Yeah. I think we have to uncover a couple of things. We have to uncover if they're the same person, what purpose would he have it's like am I you and you, why do we have, is he hiding something that Pinchas doesn't want everybody to know that it is Eliyahu? I mean, like, if Pinchas is doing what he's doing and he has the same zeal, why does he have to have another name?
In other words, if they really are the same person,
right,
then why do they have to have a separate identity?
Right.
They just go by Pinchas for all of his life. Okay,
right.
Good. Okay, that's one question we might deal with. Any other thoughts?
Are there any other actions that Eliyahu took that would demonstrate the similar zeal?
Okay, good. It's very nice that we have this one example of him being a zealous guy, but does he have any other points in his entire life where he was actually zealous? Now, I might say back to you that even though the text may not use that word many other times with Eliyahu, you could clearly tell that Eliyahu, if you know a little bit about his life, that he was a very zealous guy, right? He took on idolaters on many occasions, and he was constantly fighting for the Jewish people and for God. So he seemed to always embody those attributes, even though the text might not have always said those exact words. What I would like to examine is three questions in particular. These questions are, What was Pinchas before he became the Pinchas that we know? In other words, where did he come from? Who were his parents? What was his lineage like that he should be such a special person? Right? That's number one. Number two, we have to understand a little bit what this pact of friendship, this pact of peace, this breach shalom that God gave Pinchas as a reward for his actions. Again, we said we're not going to deal with his actions, and it is complicated theologically to understand how someone could go kill someone and then God could reward them. We're not going to deal with that question. We're going to deal with specifically what the reward that God gave him was. How do you identify it? Some might say it's just the priesthood, but others say no, there's a little bit more there. We'll see that in a moment. And then we're going to have to see what happened at the end of Pinchas' life. In other words, when was that moment of transition, or why would a person assume that Pinchas didn't die, right? Was there something that helps us believe that he actually had a much longer life, and maybe there would have been a moment that he went behind a building, he put on a different outfit, and then he started saying, I'm a new guy. So let's start with the question number one. Who were his parents? Who was his father?
Good.
Elazar, not Eliezer. Elazar, right? Who was Elazar? Who was his father?
Aaron.
Good. Aaron was his father. So Aaron was the first high priest. Who was the second? And Elazar was the second high priest, right? He was the second Kohen Gadol, right after his father passed away. So we know his father was someone special, right? Obviously. Right. Take a look at source number 7, where we learn about both of his parents. So it's a pasuk in Shemos. And say for Shemos, Elazar ben Aaron lakach lo mibnos putiel. So Elazar, Aaron's son, took a wife. Who was his wife? One of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Pinchas. Who in the world is Putiel? Anyone know?
Jethro.
Okay. Take a look at source number 8. Rashi says, you want to know who Putiel was? He says that he was of the family of Yisro, the family of Jethro. Who used to fatten calves for idolatrous sacrifice. That comes from the word patam, and that's where the Putiel patam are connected, and of the family of Joseph, who overcame, or using the word pit, his evil inclination. So in other words, what Rashi is saying over here is that Putiel sounds a lot like these other two words that were used to describe both Yisro and Yosef, and therefore, says Rashi, you know who Putiel was, and therefore you know who the daughter of Putiel was, who married Elazar. She was someone from the lineage of Yosef and from Yisro. So if you want to identify who Pinchas' holy ancestors were, so you have Aaron, you have great Yichas. He had Aaron, he had Yisro, he had Yosef, he had all the main players that you might want to be from. He was from all of these people, so that's really important to understand. Take a look at source number 8. It's the Shlach HaKadosh, who often always throws in Kabbalistic points to source. What did I say?
Eight.
Source number 9. So take a look inside. The Torah informs us that Pinchas' father had married one of the daughters of Putiel, who, according to Midrash HaGadol, fattened all the idols in the world, and the other tribes despised him on account of his ancestry. So in other words, the other tribes did not like this guy originally, because he originally might not have been the best guy in the world. But since the name Putiel concludes with the letters of the name of God, right? It says Puti, but then Aleph Lamed, which is God's name. However, the Torah alerts us to the fact that he converted to monotheism. So in other words, Putiel might not have started off as being the best guy in the world, but eventually he became a convert and he loved God and he loved monotheism and Judaism. The whole verse is an allusion to Joseph, who controlled his desire and his involvement with the wife of his master, Potiphar, whose similarly sounding name reminds us of what took place then. Just as Joseph preserved the holy covenant with God at that time, so Pinchas, his descendant, maternally restored the holy covenant with God by taking God's revenge on Zimri. As a result, God granted him my covenant of peace. In other words, what the Shlach is saying over here is that Yosef sort of protected God's name when he didn't have those illicit relations with his boss's wife back in the day. And so too, Pinchas is clearly the spiritual and actually biological progeny from him, because Pinchas also protected God's name, and that he stood up for God's name by getting revenge against Zimri and Cusbi and killing them to protect God's covenant. And that's why God rewarded him, because he has this amazing yichus, and he did everything to sort of uphold that he does have this amazing yichus. He acted just like his great-grandfather might have acted. So where did Pinchas come from? He had this amazing lineage in the background of Yosef, Yisro, Aaron. He had all these people who were behind him. Now, what was Pinchas' reward for his actions? So we said he got the Brit Shalom, he got the covenant of peace. What in the world does the covenant of peace mean?
Didn't have any stress. I mean, peace, no stress.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Like things went easy. He didn't have anxiety. anxiety.
Okay, take a look at source number 12 real quick. Let's skip ahead. So Carol and Ahim Akdover, the Netziv, right? Rabbi Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin from 19th century Volozhin, says exactly like you. Take a look at source number 12. My covenant of peace, Pinchas was promised he would not become an agitated and angry person from the nature of the act he did. Killing a person with his hands leaves a strong impression. However, since he did it for the sake of heaven, he received a blessing that he would always be in peace and serenity. Right? So this is exactly what Carol was saying, that he did something that was very violent and horrible, right? We have this nowadays when people like to bring up video games as something terrible for the young generation to be playing with. Why? Because it causes someone to become more violent if they're watching all this violence. And that's exactly what the Netziv says. Pinchas wasn't just watching or doing something on a video game. He literally took a spear and stabbed two people in front of everyone. He did have a violent act, but the Netziv says that the promise of peace that was given to him was that this would not affect him. It should have affected him, but miraculously God said, no, this will not affect you. You will not become an angry person because of this. What are some other thoughts of what the covenant of peace might mean?
Well, I take it to mean that he became a Kohen because the descendants of Aaron are Kohanim, and Aaron is known for peace, shalom, Rodev shalom. Okay. So that's, I make that connection.
Okay, good. So it seems that that connection is sort of intuitively there. I think what all the commentators pick up on is, why does the Torah need to say two things, right? Either say he got a covenant of peace, and the commentators can then say, oh, that means kahuna, or just say that he becomes a Kohen, right? But the fact that the Torah says both, that he became a Kohen, and he also got this covenant of peace, so that's why people say it must mean something different. So what might that different thing be? So take a look at source number 10. Rashi, what does Rashi say? I give to him my covenant of peace. This means, I give him my covenant that it should be to him as a covenant of peace, just like a man who shows gratitude and friendliness to one who has done him a kindness. So here too, the Holy One, blessed be he, expressed to him his peaceful feelings towards him. In other words, what's Rashi saying? What was this covenant of peace?
That he's going to be, you know, that God's going to like him and he's going to be all around. Everything is going to be okay for him. You know, he's not going to be tortured by this, what he did.
Okay, I would tell you that I think you're reading a little too much into what Rashi's saying. I think he's just saying, God was saying, like, nice job. Like, you did a great job, Pinchas, though. That was his way of saying, like, Yashar Koach, you know?
Okay, just one little question.
Yeah.
This, when they're referring to Yosef, you know,
yeah.
That was before we got the commandments.
Yes.
They're going back before this.
Yes.
Before the commandments
yes.
were given to us.
Yes.
They're discussing what God wasn't even on the presence. It was the presence after that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, our belief is, again, we can have a lot of interesting discussions about this, but our general belief is that even though the commandments weren't given then, that Yosef did believe in God and he did follow some sort of commandments that he might have learned from his forefathers.
Right.
From his fathers.
So technically Hashem was there all this time.
That's what we believe in.
I mean that's since Abraham.
Right.
Before that.
Right.
That's what we believe in.
Yeah, right, okay. Because I see that here in the Midrash they're talking about them. So we knew about that.
Yes.
Like, even if we didn't know about the commandments, we knew about Yosef.
Well,
there's
a very complicated Gemara that we won't go into too much right now, but discussing the forefathers, there is a Gemara that says that the forefathers kept all the commandments. Now, what does that mean exactly? A lot of commentators struggle with that, because how would they know what the commandments are? Some say, that they just intuitively knew it, because that's how in touch they were with the world. But not a conversation for now, but it could be that they actually did keep all the commandments. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, take a look at source number 11. Now, the Chizkuni, right, from 13th century France, he says, you want to know what it means that he got this covenant of peace? It means that there was no need to fear the relatives of Zimri and Cusby, right? So forget about the fact that God gave him a Yashar Koach, or that God told him that he's not going to have any anxiety from this. No, he doesn't have to be afraid of that there's going to be vengeance from the family of Zimri or Cusby, right? Even though we see, in retrospect, the amazing thing that Pinchas did, and even though the plague stopped because of his actions, the families of Zimri and Cusby probably didn't immediately see it like that. They said, why did you just kill our brother and sister or whatever? So the fact that no one went after Pinchas and no one tried to kill him from these families was an absolute miracle. And says the Chizkuni, that's the Brit Shalom, that's the covenant of peace that he gave him, that no one would harm him, even though he should have been harmed in theory. Okay. Take a look at one final source on this idea. Take a look at source number 13, the Sforno, who is from 16th century Italy. He says, you want to know what it means, the covenant of peace? Source number 13, peace with the angel of death. We find that as a result of this shalom, this peace or armistice with the angel of death, Pinchas enjoyed an exceedingly long life on earth, more so than any other member of his generation. In fact, he was still serving as priest in the tabernacle at Shiloh during the civil war between Benjamin and the other tribes. This occurred many years after the death of Joshua and the elders who were Joshua's assistants. If, as indicated by the Talmud, Pinchas was still alive in the days of Yiftach, he must have been 300 years old by that time. Now, what does this do for us? Not only
it makes him seem more like Eliyahu if he was alive for 300 years.
Good. Not only does it answer the question of what the Brit Shalom actually is, of what this covenant of peace might be, right? According, again, to the Sforno, that means that the angel of death wasn't allowed to kill him for many years, but it also might mean that if you're going to say that Pinchas lived to be so old, now maybe he never died. Or maybe, yeah, he just became Eliyahu at some point. So let's see source number 14. So source number 14, so now we're going to transition into answering this third question. What happened to Pinchas at the end of his life? Now that we know where he came from, we know what this, we saw the different perspectives of what this Brit Shalom, what this covenant of peace might be, what actually happened to Pinchas at the end of his life? So if we assume that he lived for this long, can we say that he actually lived forever? So take a look at 14. Again, it's the Targum.
15.
No, 14. Yeah, it's on the right. Sorry, it's only in Hebrew. I'm sorry. Well, don't worry. We'll translate. But just to give a little background about source number 14. Source number 14 is what they call Targum Yonasan. Now, the problem is that there is no Targum Yonasan on the Torah, but there was a mistake made a number of years ago that they said that it had the letters Tuf Yud as like an abbreviation at the top of it. So everyone assumed, oh, this must be Targum Yonasan, but it can't be because Targum Yonasan never wrote a translation in Aramaic of the Torah. So therefore, a lot of people go back and forth of who this might be, but the academics call him Pseudo-Jonathan, right? Jonathan from like Yonatan, and pseudo because it's not actually him, but everyone thinks it's him. So let's call him Targum Yonasan regardless, but just so you know, it's not actually him. So let's see what he writes. It's in Aramaic, but we'll take it slow and we'll translate. B'shvua emar lei min shmi ha'ana gazar lei yask yamei shalom. That God gave this man, Pinchas, some covenant of peace. He swore him a covenant of peace. So what was the covenant? Says the Targum Yonasan, the abidine malach kiyam. He's going to turn into a malach. He became like an angel almost. The yecheli alma. He is going to live forever. L'mivshara geulta besof yomaya. And what is he going to do? He's going to be the one who announces the good news at the end of days that Mashiach has come. That's what this guy is going to be. That's what Pinchas became. That's what this perspective said over here. So what does that tell us?
That he is Eliyahu.
Sounds a lot like Eliyahu now, right? Getting much warmer. Now, if he is Eliyahu, then we need to know two things. One, well, let's take for one thing right now. We need to know how it is, how do we say this? Okay, if Pinchas was Eliyahu, we need to know that Pinchas actually did live forever, right? Right? We agree, because Eliyahu lived forever. Eliyahu never died. So let's take a look at source number 15. Source number 15 is the very famous statement from the Derech Eretz Zuta. Derech Eretz Zuta is one of what we call the minor tractates, the Masechtot Ketanot. And here it lists a very interesting list of people. Everyone in Jewish history who never died. Tisha nechnesu b'chayehim began Eden. There were nine people, says the Derech Eretz Zuta, that entered into Gan Eden, that entered into the Garden of Eden, that entered in living. They didn't have to die again, and they got the free ticket even though they were still alive. The Elohim, these are them. Chanoch ben Yared, who the academics called Enoch, that was his English name. Chanoch or Enoch, who's alive around the times of Noach. He's another interesting person, but not for right now. The Eliyahu. Eliyahu is one of those people who we know live forever. Umashiach. The Eliezer Eved Avram. This is interesting. The servant of Avram, Eliezer, he lived forever. The Chiram Melech Tzora, king. The Eved Melech Hakushi. The Yavetz Beno Shel Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Now that's getting a little bit more interesting because now we're talking about post-biblical times. Evidently, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the one who compiled the Mishnah, he lived forever. Ubatia Bas Paro, right? That's Paro's daughter who saved Moshe. She got the cut. The Serach Bas Asher. Who was Serach Bas Asher? Anyone know? She was the very famous person who we're told, she was the one who told Yaakov that Yosef was still alive, that she sang a song for him. And we're told that she got a reward, that she got to live forever because of this. Some people say, no, it's actually, we don't count Chiram Melech Tzor, we actually say Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, that he got to go in. So what's noteworthy about this list? Who's not on it?
Pinchas
is not on it. So is that a problem or not?
Depends.
depends whether or not he's Eliyahu.
Ah, okay, good. So there are a few implications that you might take out of this. One is to say that Pinchas is who?
Eliyahu.
Eliyahu, and therefore he is on the list. Okay, what else might you say? Maybe Pinchas, who's Mashiach? It just says Mashiach. Maybe right. Pinchas is Mashiach. Maybe he's not Eliyahu, but he's Mashiach, right? Because we said in the previous source that he was going to be the one to usher in the end of days.
Right.
So maybe he's actually going to be Mashiach, could be. The third possibility is that what? Pinchas is just not on the list, right? That's it.
That's it.
He's not on the list. He didn't make the cut. There are a lot of sources that seem to imply, even very mystical sources, that Pinchas was the same person as Eliyahu. But the source that says the list of people who live forever, which Pinchas would have had to, his name is not explicitly on the list. So maybe you can argue that he actually did not live forever, and therefore he actually was not Eliyahu, and therefore he did not. This actually was never true, that he was never actually Eliyahu. Now, where does this leave us? So many sources, some that seem to imply that Pinchas and Eliyahu were the same person, some that seem to imply that we're not so sure that he was the same person. Many sources that seem to talk about the greatness of who Pinchas was, both where he came from, what he got as a reward for his amazing actions, and then how he lived out, for sure, an amazing long life afterwards. And this only question that we have is exactly if he really was Eliyahu or not, and it seems that the jury is still out. Now, I have no conclusions for you. I think that we just have to be stuck with that tension because it's hard to say for sure. My question for you is what's the takeaway from all of this? What's the message that we're supposed to learn from this? Why would anyone in the first place, even if we don't believe that Pinchas and Eliyahu were actually the same biological person, why would we taught that? What's the message of all of this? What are we trying to learn here?
Can a man, like Pinchas, if he started out to be a man, could the man evolve into, could an ordinary person, who was kind and wonderful as Pinchas was, could he end up living forever and become a Navi? Or could a Navi be a man?
Okay. In other words, you're saying, can someone...
What will be somebody above that?
Okay, interesting. In other words, can it be that you could have someone like Pinchas, who just started off as a mere mortal,
right,
become someone like Eliyahu, who became a prophet, and then
prophet, right, yeah,
became immortal? Could it? Okay, interesting. Any other thoughts?
Pinchas was so true to himself, and... No, that's something you could take from it and wouldn't let anything stop him from...
Okay.
Well, I think you can take that, I mean, not to be overly spiritual
I don't want to do that.
And ridiculously ethical, but to take that a step further, there's no telling who's going to make that list. So what you choose to do in your life, you've got to do in your life... You know, regardless of the schar.
Okay. So I'll tell you a few final thoughts that I had concluding this talk. So one is an interesting idea that I saw written in the name of Rabbi David Feinstein. He says that you had two people, Pinchas, who was an amazing human being, and he was a very violent man. Right? He did this terrible act. And you had someone like Eliyahu, who also had a tremendous amount of zeal. The stories told about Eliyahu are absolutely, that's almost hard to believe. We do believe them, but they're hard to believe. It's hard to really understand that he was able to do some of the things that he did, and the amount of zeal and the amount of passion that he brought to the world. So the point where you're like, should you actually be that zealous? And so Rabbi David Feinstein, again, it could be he didn't say it, but I heard it quoted in his name, that we don't like people with that much passion. We like passion, but not that much passion. People who are willing to kill for God, we don't go that far. And so if we're going to say that there was someone like that, which you see that in Pinchas, and you see that maybe even in Eliyahu, Chazal said it can't be that there were two people like that that we considered righteous in human history. It has to be that they were the same person, simply because we cannot believe that there would be two people like that that we would both consider are righteous. It has to be that they're the same person. That's one perspective. The takeaway, I think, for us, though, regardless of all of this, again, seeing how amazing Pinchas was, seeing how amazing Eliyahu was, and realizing that we ourselves should never go as far as Pinchas did to go kill someone. We certainly don't have that right to do that. But in 2019, and especially, you know, in the middle of the beginning of the 3 weeks, realizing the amount of passion that both Pinchas and Eliyahu had, is that something that we have in our lives? And we spoke a little bit about this past Shabbos, about how one of the main things that seems to have been the issue when it came to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, right? Why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed?
Baseless hatred.
Everyone, famous answer, baseless hatred. What about the, we asked the question of Rosh Shabbos, what about the 20 other Gemaras that tell you the other reasons why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed? There's one Gemara that says the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because people didn't say Kriya Shema twice a day. What about those Gemaras? So I suggested, again, in my share of Rosh Shabbos, that it could be that we have no idea why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. There were dozens, hundreds maybe, of reasons why people posited of what the Jewish people did wrong that made the Beis HaMikdash be destroyed. But what's the overarching, all-encompassing answer that it seems to sum everything up? It's a lack of passion. Once you begin to become dry and stagnant and don't actually care with a fire about your Judaism and your Jewish life anymore, once you're living in a society where the Beis HaMikdash has been around for 600 years, right? That's approximately how many years the second Beis HaMikdash was around. Once you're alive in that society for so many hundreds of years and you just begin to take everything for granted, you begin to take everything as a given, you no longer have that fire, you no longer have that passion. And perhaps the all-encompassing answer of the reason why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed is because the Jewish soul, in many senses of the word, died, and that passion died out. There was no more fire, there was no more fight for Judaism. And perhaps the takeaway lesson is of both Pinchas and Eliyahu is that, again, we do not believe in killing other people, but do we have that passion that even comes close to that, that we'll do whatever it takes to fight for Judaism and for a strong Jewish life for ourselves and for future generations?
Not as a people, but there are people that have passion.
There are people that have passion, but
maybe not globally.
I think in today's generation,
there's a lot of lack. A lot of people, you know, feel this passion. I mean, you talk about all the kids that are getting involved now to make sure that, you know, with APAC and to, you know,
100%.
And that they have the passion to keep us alive.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot do this.
But on the other hand, I think that I went to an APAC event and I heard somebody speak. And what is the biggest difference between anti-Semitism 75 years ago and anti-Semitism today? Israel. So, you know, people were much more passionate because we needed something to unite us.
Right.
Now, a lot of people take Israel for granted. It's there. We don't have to fight for it. It's there. People, I think, intellectualize the fact that, yes, Israel needs the United States. Yes, the United States needs Israel. But they're gonna survive.
I hope.
And they're gonna survive in spite of us.
Right.
But in other words, I'm not talking about people around this table necessarily. Yeah. I'm talking about the greater Jewish people. Right. It's there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's a lot of anger in there. That 100%. Might get thing. You know, you can't be angry with each other.
Well,
I mean, you can be, but you should not be.
Yeah.
We should protect each other no matter what.